This is Booktown. You're new here, aren't you? Maybe I should show you around. You can get anything you want here. Anything you want. Anything you desire. Anything you can imagine. It's all here. It's all free. It's all for you. Come on. I'll show you around. If you've got the guts. This is Booktown. You can get anything you want here. Anything you need.
And this is Booktown on KVMR FM in Nevada City. I'm Eric Tome. I'll be with you till 2 p.m. This afternoon, we're going to look at two recent books having basically to do with race relations in the Pacific area, especially California, but going all the way from China, Hawaii, and a large chunk of Western North America. Both books center in the 1890s, but have side effects, or certainly repercussions, right up to the present day. In the first half of the program, I'm going to be talking with Gene Feltzer, who's professor of English, East Asian Studies, and American Studies at the University of Delaware. Her new book is called Driven Out, The Forgotten War Against Chinese Americans. And in the second half of the program, I'll be talking with novelist James D. Houston about his new novel, Bird of Another Heaven, which takes place largely in California and Hawaii in the late 1880s and 90s. It has to do with the consort of the last king of Hawaii, who is partly Hawaiian and partly Native American, and then again the repercussions right up into the last few years. The story of Chinese-American relations, and especially of the way Chinese have made their way in America, has been told many times. But after reading Driven Out, Gene Feltzer's new account of the Forgotten War Against Chinese-Americans, I begin to think that every other version I've read has been somewhat, well, to say the least, sugar-coated. This is a pretty brutally detailed account of many activities that took place up and down the West Coast, but especially in California. Welcome to Booktown, Professor Feltzer, and what drew you to this subject?
Thank you for having me. What drew me to this subject was during the 1970s, I was teaching at Humboldt State in Northern California, and I grew up in California. I was born in Los Angeles. And I looked around my classroom at Humboldt State, and there were no Asian students. Humboldt State has an unusual mix of white students who are very committed to environmental studies, marine studies, and a large community from six local Native American tribes. But there were no Asian kids. It was a very active time. It was the last year of the Vietnam War, the Civil Rights Movement, and the Native American students were demanding a lot of changes at Humboldt State. So people were getting together all the time, but there were no Asian kids. And when I started asking around, hey, this doesn't look like California, I was told that the Chinese wouldn't come to Eureka. They wouldn't send their kids to Humboldt State because 100 years ago the Chinese had been driven out. Initially, I thought it was one town. But as soon as I got into reading the old newspapers, I thought, there goes Truckee, there goes Petaluma, there goes Stockton, there goes San Jose, there goes Antioch. And I realized within a few hours that this was an untold story of both ethnic cleansing and resistance in the Pacific Northwest.
You start out with events in Tacoma, in Washington, but in 1885, but most of what you write about is centered in California. Was this because there were more Chinese in California?
There were more Chinese in California. In the 1880s, I believe there were probably about 100,000 people, Chinese people, in California, and about 10,000 more Chinese Americans, the first Chinese Americans elsewhere in the United States. So there was more violence, more contact, more tension. And I believe people came to California with very high expectations. Immigrants came from Eastern Europe and from Ireland, coming to the Golden State with hopes for a great deal of money, independence from family, a kind of freedom. And when those dreams were frustrated, they turned on to the Chinese.
The people we tend, at least people like myself, tend to think of as the good guys in this context, the workers who were fighting against the land barons and the railroads and the large corporations that sprang up in California almost as soon as European Americans got here. We think of these Irish, German, and other immigrant laborers as being the people who started the labor movement in the United States, and we tend to naturally sympathize with them, but they were the ones who were most adamant to get rid of the Chinese.
I think that that's part of the story, but what I found as I got deeper into the research was that the received story, that it was the white working class, the Irish, the early Knights of Labor who turned on the Chinese, is only part of the story, because the leadership of many of these routs, pogroms, the driven out, were judges, were mayors up in Truckee. It was the editor of the Truckee Republican, the newspaper. In Tacoma, it was the mayor. In Humboldt County, it was the county board of supervisors and the mayor and the timber barons. So people crossed their class interests, which you'd think would be to have a low-paid working force, in order to drive out the Chinese.
Well, the timber barons and railroads, as you're talking about, had been the ones who had most benefited from having the Chinese here. They were the ones who did a lot of the, well, probably as much work as any other group on the Transcontinental Railroad, and they were welcome until the railroad was finished and then suddenly unneeded.
That's right. After the Transcontinental Railroad finished in 1869, 11,000 Chinese people come down from the mountains. This is the men, and the women's story is somewhat different, but the men come down from the mountains and settle in rural towns, in the foothills, in the Sierras, in the Siskiyous, and along the coast, all the way up through Seattle. And what I think is that the leadership in these towns, no one expected all of a sudden to have a very organized Chinese community arrive so quickly. In Truckee, a third of the town was suddenly Chinese Americans who had come off the railroad and settled in Truckee. Much to the benefit of the town, suddenly there was a workforce to cut wood, build the trellises, build the extensions of the railroad, work in the laundries, work in the hotels, work in the restaurants. But the town was quite surprised to see itself suddenly one-third Chinese American.
And I guess the first attempt to take care of this problem, if you want to look at it that way, was on a national level with the Chinese Exclusion Act in 1882. But then local individuals began taking things into their own hands.
The first attempts to drive out the Chinese were really right as soon as they got here. In the Gold Rush era, the Chinese were driven off the mines. They were driven off the good portions of the river where there might be a lot of placer gold. The state passed the foreign miners tax originally to drive the Chileans and the Argentinians and the Peruvians and Mexicans off the mines. After they leave, when the Chinese come into the gold fields, they transfer the foreign miners' tax to the Chinese, and it's a back-breaking tax, and Chinese are assaulted time and time again for not paying. In Los Angeles, in 1871, long before this period, 17 Chinese people are lynched in downtown Los Angeles. It begins as very much as soon as the Chinese get here. But by the 1880s, it's really the apocalypse of violence. It's a firestorm of pogroms against the Chinese.
Now, your book is specifically about the Chinese, but you just mentioned the discrimination against Latin American minors, and certainly the violence against the Native Americans was perhaps the worst. And you see that as a prelude to what happened to the Chinese.
It's a prelude. It's a model or a template, because the purge of Native American people comes later to the West than it did in the East Coast with the Trail of Tears. And it's happening in the Northwest just at this time. So there's the idea that it's okay to have a mass removal of a people. And the American military and white townspeople are watching this happen so that the timber barons can take over Native American forests and pasture land, and to do that, they need to move out the Native American people. So this possibility was very close at hand.
And then the actual removal of the Native Americans from the most desirable land occurred very quickly. It was pretty much finished by 1860.
In the Northwest, it goes on and on, partly because Native American people refused to stay removed. And so, for example, up on the Klamath Reservation, they come back. As soon as the intense guards leave the Klamath Reservation, they leave and go back to their native land.
But nonetheless, the major removal had occurred then, and then the removals of the Latin American miners, and then the Chinese. And the Chinese were considerably more difficult than any of the other groups. They resisted, and they seemed to know how to organize much better.
Yeah, the Chinese fought back in small ways and large ways. They filed the first lawsuits for reparations in this country and actually won several hundred thousand dollars from local governments and from Congress in order to be paid back not only for the damages, but, for example, in Eureka, for being the objects of mob violence. They demanded to be paid back for the racism of these deeds. And then there were smaller gestures. In several towns, laundries returned dirty laundry folded but unwashed. Vegetable peddlers refused to sell to hotels or housewives that supported the pogroms or supported the boycotts. The Chinese bought arms from China, and as up in Truckee, they tried to refuse to leave. And after the, quote, peaceful boycott up in Truckee, which took 10 weeks, the starving them out that happened up in Truckee, the few that remained stayed in their houses, and they were finally burned out and killed.
In your book, in Driven Out, your chapters, for the most part, are thematic. Toward the end, you have a chronology, a litany of hate that goes year by year and city by city of all the activities. I'm amazed at how thorough you've been, but I'm also amazed at how thorough the attempts were. I guess local newspapers would actually carry accounts of anti-Chinese activities in other areas just to keep their local populations up to date with whether they were falling behind, I guess, in other areas.
This is the time of the telegraph and the popularity of the telegraph. And I have this image of newspaper editors sitting up all night wiring each other what was going on in the various towns. It was almost like people on email late at night keeping in touch with each other. Often they just cut and copied from one town to the next. But there were many, many newspapers that had a column, depending on how often the newspaper ran, daily, weekly, of a column of the purges, a long list, bringing people up to date of which towns, Petaluma, Truckee, Ukiah, Sonoma, Antioch, as each town purged the Chinese, then those events and those efforts would be put on this list.
And in the end, you come up with two sort of models. You go through a number of particular topics like the gold rush and how women were affected in particular, but then you settle on the Eureka Method and the Truckee Method. What were these?
Well, the Eureka Method, the Tacoma Method, was a swift, short, violent purge. In Eureka, it took 24 hours to cleanse, if you will, Eureka of its entire Chinese population, where the Chinese were rounded up, marched down to the docks. They had a few hours during the night to pack up their belongings. The sheriff ordered a few carts, and whatever they could take with them was taken down to the docks, and they were loaded onto two ships that sailed out of Humboldt Bay. The Chinese immediately gather that same afternoon that they get to San Francisco and announce that they're going to sue Eureka for reparations. And that lawsuit put other towns on notice. This is also a very Christian era, and people were embarrassed, perhaps, or felt immoral for the real exuberance of the violence against the Chinese people in Tacoma and Eureka. And in Truckee, the editor of the Truckee Republican, Charles McLachlan, decides that he's going to attempt to do a peaceful purge, and it takes 10 weeks, and they call it the freeze out or the starving out or the Truckee Method. And there it was done through shaming and boycotting. McLachlan went house to house, telling anybody that they could not hire, rent to, speak with, shop from, rent lodgings to any Chinese person. And mainly that they couldn't have any contracts to cut wood from the Chinese people who were cutting wood for the railroads all over the mountains. And he forcibly and through humiliation brings merchant by merchant, woodcutter by woodcutter into line until almost all of the Chinese are gone from the mountains. And then with the few remaining Chinese living in the last Chinatown across the Truckee River, where they've been banned after a series of fires in Truckee's Chinatown. Right at the end, they burn Chinatown. They invite the ladies to watch, and they bring in a fire engine that had been specially bought to protect all these wood buildings from fire, from burning down. But they say that the engine is too can't get down to the river, and it can only face the white part of town, and Chinatown burns, and the few Chinese who are holding out in their houses across the river are killed in the fire.
Now, you're going to be speaking in Truckee tomorrow, and I guess there is some talk of making amends.
That's right. There is a motion, as I understand it, in front of the city council right now for Truckee to issue an apology. Many towns just now, really in the past few months, want to have some reckoning toward racial healing and to help the diversity of their community. In Tacoma, Washington, the Chinese community has been working since 1992 and has purchased, in an exchange with the Army Corps of Engineers and the National Guard, has gotten 4 acres of beautiful waterfront land on Puget Sound, and they're building the Chinese Reconciliation Park in honor of what happened to the Chinese. And within the Chinese garden that they're building, there will be a trail of expulsion with markers talking about the morning that the Chinese were driven out of town in 4 hours. And there is this motion before the Tacoma City Council that I believe is happening as we speak, and I think people will talk about it tomorrow night.
And where are you speaking tomorrow night?
Tomorrow night I'll be speaking in Truckee at 6 o'clock, and it's in the one remaining Chinese building in town. It's now called the Chinese Herb Shop. At various times in its past, I believe it had been an opium den. I believe it had been a house of prostitution. And it's been saved and restored as the Chinese herb store.
This is Booktown on KVMR FM in Nevada City. I'm Eric Tome. I'm talking with Gene Feltzer, professor of English, East Asian Studies, and American Studies at the University of Delaware, about her book, Driven Out, The Forgotten War Against Chinese Americans. The ironic thing is that after this decade through the 80s, and you detail all of the brutality of, the Chinese population in Western, on the West Coast, really declined only very slightly.
The Chinese stay. The efforts to drive the Chinese people out work in many towns. In 1886, there's an anti-Chinese convention in Sacramento, and the towns that want to do it want to go to the Sacramento convention, the anti-Chinese convention, quote, clean of Chinese people. It was actually led by Charles McGlashan, the editor of the Truckee newspaper. And the efforts to purge the Chinese drop off from 86 to the early 90s. And then there's a last brutal firestorm in the 1890s when Congress passes an act that says that every Chinese person in this country has to carry on their body a photo identity card. And 110,000 Chinese people refuse to carry a photo identity card. This is, of course, coming back to us in the Patriot Act, where on our driver's licenses, all of our driver's licenses by the year 2010, there's going to be a barcode. And embedded in the barcode will be our Social Security number, our travel history, our personal data, our economic data. And that will become the first internal passport that the United States has ever had. I hope we have the courage that the 110,000 Chinese had to not carry that card.
On the other hand, it was more effective than the violent purges in reducing the Chinese population.
What happens with the photo identity card is that the Chinese lose the strongest thing they have at their back, which is China. As long as they had China at their back, they had the finances to hire lawyers, to organize petition drives, to put pressure on the president and on Congress to back off, to keep some things under control. What happens with the Photo Identity Act is that China wants a trade treaty with the United States. And when China buckles and decides it would rather have trade than support what was called at the time the overseas Chinese, then they're open, then they're vulnerable, and they do sign up for the photo identity cards. Interestingly, National Archives, which keeps everything, destroyed all the photo identity cards. I was only able to find four, and that was with the efforts of an archivist to go through boxes and boxes of personally donated papers. Most of the photo identity cards are kept within the families.
And basically, these attitudes continued right into World War II.
The Chinese are not allowed back in the country from 1902 until 1943. Chinese are not allowed to immigrate into the United States. In 1943, the Exclusion Act is banned. And that's because we're at war with Japan, and China's at war with Japan. And this was a sop to China to allow Chinese to emigrate from China and come to the United States. In fact, only about 100 come in 1943. And it's really not until the 50s that people really start another wave of immigration from China to the United States.
And, of course, the accommodation with the Chinese occurred just at the same time as the internment of the Japanese Americans.
It did. And the anti-Asian comments slide between the two different groups. In Oakland, you see signs that say, I'm Chinese, I'm not Japanese, that there was considerable hatred and warfare between China and Japan. And tragically, it comes into play during the period of the internment of Japanese Americans.
I've been speaking with Jean Feltzer, a professor at the University of Delaware, about her book, Driven Out, The Forgotten War Against Chinese Americans, which has just been published by Random House. You'll be speaking at the Chinese Herb Shop in Truckee tomorrow evening at, did you say 7?
At 6.
At 6. Okay, well, thanks so much for being with us, and good luck with the reception of your book.
Thank you. Thank you for listening to this very troubling story.
This is Booktown on KBMR FM in Nevada City. I'm Eric Tome. I'll be with you till 2 p.m. This afternoon is sort of Pacific Rim Relations Day. We've just been talking in the first half of the program with Jean Feltzer about her book, Driven Out, the Forgotten War Against Chinese Americans. I now have on the phone the distinguished American novelist James D. Houston, whose novels include Continental Drift, Love Life, The Last Paradise, Snow Mountain Passage. And he, in some ways, is best known for the book Farewell to Manzanar, which he co-authored with his wife, Jeannie Watsuki Houston. He has a new novel called Bird of Another Heaven, which jumps back and forth between the 1880s and 90s, when American influence in Hawaii was first, well, I'd say was reaching its peak and resulted in the destruction of the Kingdom of Hawaii. Flashes between that and the 1980s in the Bay Area. The main narrator of the book is a talk show host named Sheridan Brody on a station very much like KPFA in Berkeley, who discovers as his station and his program are being threatened by a media conglomerate, he begins to learn about his great-grandmother, who had been the companion, trusted companion of the last king of Hawaii. She, however, was not pure Hawaiian. She was Hawaiian and Native American. Her father had been one of the Hawaiians who came to America to join with John Sutter in his attempt to set up his own empire in the Sacramento area, and then after leaving Sutter, joined a Native American tribe and gave birth to Nani, who is the central character in the novel. That was a very long introduction, James Houston, but it's a fascinating, multi-leveled book, and I wanted to get at least the essentials out of the way before we started talking.
That was a good introduction. You pulled a lot of things together there.
You seem to have always had a fascination with Asian American relations. Of course, being married to a Japanese American, that makes a great deal of sense. But I guess you've also spent a lot of time in Hawaii.
I've spent a lot of time in Hawaii and traveled a good bit around Asia. But, you know, growing up on the Pacific Coast, I grew up in San Francisco. I was born in San Francisco and spent my early years there when it was already a very diverse, culturally diverse city. And the West Coast always faces toward the Pacific, and the Pacific has always fascinated me. It was always a presence in my life. So the ocean was there, and a culturally diverse community was there from my early years, and so my attention has always been drawn out in that direction from early in life.
It's sort of the center of the book, well, it's hard to say. I guess the real center is what happens with Nani Kaala all through her life, the journals she keeps, but the sort of the possible hidden treasure in the book is a recording that could have been made by the last Hawaiian king, David Talakaua. I still have trouble with that, thank you. Uh-huh. In the Palace Hotel in 1891, a few days before he died. I guess there is a real recording made on one of the early Edison wax cylinders where he sends his greetings to the people of Hawaii. But in the novel, you suggest that he may have made a second recording, which would have maybe had the effect of arousing Hawaiian spirit against the impending American takeover.
Yeah. That's based on an actual episode when right toward the end of his life, when Talakaua was trying to recover from a flu and a couple of other conditions, the San Francisco manager of the Edison Electric Company got permission to bring one of those early recording machines up into the Palace Hotel with a wax cylinder. He wanted to. This was before Edison and anybody else was recording music. Edison himself was much more interested in recording the voices of famous people. And Kalakaua was a king from the mid-Pacific, but with a terrific curiosity about all kinds of new inventions. And so he loved the idea of a recording machine and allowed his voice to be recorded. And whatever is on that cylinder is thought to be his last words. And that cylinder is now, the original wax cylinder is in the Bishop Museum in Honolulu. And I just cranked that situation up a little bit and added a second cylinder that he recorded on the same day, which subsequently gets lost. But in that second cylinder, he speaks in a kind of coded Hawaiian poetic language that English speakers, non-Hawaiian speakers, would not be able to understand, but would be an extended message to his people at the time of this tremendous pressure they were under. Their culture was being threatened, you know, and to stand strong and do what they could to reclaim their culture and reclaim their ancestral terrain. And this is built into this second, longer coded message that disappears and becomes part of the quest of the novel as this guy Sheridan Brody, 100 years later, learns about his great-grandmother's role in that moment in the king's life and tries to find out the truth of what really happened in the Palace Hotel.
And the story that he chanted would have been the story of Nani's father, Keala, who had come to America to go, well, he had left Hawaii because he had had a fight with one of the missionary sons who were already at that time in the 1830s threatening to take over the country. He took off with Sutter and then headed up through the San Francisco Bay, through the Delta and up the Sacramento River, which at that time for foreigners was a very difficult journey. They had no idea really where they were going. And I guess his you're suggesting that his voyage and then his return, supposed return to Hawaii, had become a great legend of the time, and could have encouraged the Hawaiians to resist the Americans.
Yeah, there's the story of Nani's father joining Sutter and coming to California, which the Hawaiians called Kaleponi, which was a specific place but also already had a kind of legendary dimension to it as anything lying farther east from Hawaii. And the story of the father becomes the subject of a song and chant that is composed by the sailors who are traveling with him, and that kind of evolves over time to be a larger, more mythic chant of the wanderer who leaves Hawaii and goes to a far land to the east and then comes back home, kind of re-empowered. And Kalakaua, in his last days, uses that legend, and the poetry of that legend and the myth of that legend to communicate a larger message to his people.
And what was happening at that time was that, and Nani Kaala is really the symbol of this, is that European white forces were essentially taking over all of America, wiping out the native peoples here, and doing the same thing in Hawaii, and essentially forbidding the teaching of either Hawaiian or Native American languages for many, many years. And then in the modern counterpoint to that is the threat that the radio station that Sheridan Brody works at is being taken over by an East Coast conglomerate that is going to drastically change its whole programming. Is there more than what I've just said to tie all that together?
Well, there's when you have two large contests like that going on in the same book, you know, they ought to be connected some way. And I got really interested in the whole history of manifest destiny as a feature of the settlement of North America, and which came with terrific economic and military benefit to the essentially Anglo and European population of the country who was doing the new settling, but a tremendous cultural cost to the tribal people in North America who paid the price of that huge growth and military and economic advantage. And the same thing happened in Hawaii, because once the forces of manifest destiny reached the West Coast here in California, there was a desire to push farther west and move out into the Pacific with that same kind of conquesting energy and find military and trade bases that would extend our economic and military power farther west, and Hawaii was central to that. And the Hawaiians suffered a similar fate to Native Americans. The people who ended up taking over Hawaii brought great economic advantage and military advantage to this mid-Pacific archipelago, but a huge cost was paid by the Hawaiians, whose language was taken away from them and whose cultural significance was minimized for a long, long time. So you got, on one hand, it depends on who you're talking to. Manifest destiny brought great benefits, but in every case, just unbearable cultural costs all along the way.
And even the economic benefits mostly redounded to the whites.
Absolutely.
They were the ones who, I guess, starting in the 1820s and 30s, had started sugar plantations in Hawaii, and then it got to be to their advantage to be able to sell the sugar without a tariff to the United States. And then the United States began to say, well, we'll continue this, but we want a naval base at Pearl Harbor. And the last king, Kalakaua, refused to do this. And you suggest he may have been poisoned.
Well, he was caught in the jaws of history there. He was a man who was deeply devoted to his cultural tradition and to the music and the dance and the language and the mythology and the traditional practices of his people. But at the same time, he was fascinated with all things Western, like the telephone and like the recording machine. And here come these guys from Washington, D.C. who want Pearl Harbor specifically. And also, in order to get Pearl Harbor, they want to get control of the whole kingdom of Hawaii, which was still a separate country, a sovereign nation. And Kalakaua didn't want to give up any part of his kingdom or his country or his homeland to a foreign power. But the pressures from the United States were huge. And in the end, a coalition of island businessmen and United States Marines overthrow the monarchy and bring the period of Hawaiian rule of Hawaii, ruled by Hawaiians, to an end. And it's really regarded now as America's first exercise in regime change, which is the pattern we've seen in our foreign policy repeated several times in the last 100 years. But getting back to the radio station, I didn't want to hammer this too heavily, but that what you see so much in the media these days with all the conglomerate large takeover of not only radio stations, but television stations, newspapers, magazines, you get a movement toward homogenization and an erosion of the differences and the individuality of a certain radio station in a certain region, the bringing in of canned programming, the dumbing down of the kind of music that is offered, and it's our contemporary version of manifest destiny. You know, you get this kind of global marketing strategies that have huge economic benefits, but the downside is there's a cultural loss. There's a dumbing down of content. Pretty soon, you know, the dream world for certain marketing people is everybody wearing the same pair of jeans at the same time and listening to the same song and drinking the same beverage out of the same cup. And that's the way you make the most money. But you lose so much in the process. And it seemed to me that there was a parallel between that impulse in our time and that earlier form of manifest destiny 100 years ago.
One of the most chilling parts of the book to me is the description of the Sutter Company, the small group of, I think it was 10 Hawaiians, maybe 9 Americans, and Sutter himself, going in their small boats up into the Central Valley into places that very few non-Americans, non-natives had ever been. It sounds like it was as close to an earthly paradise as you could have found.
Well, the Central Valley in those days, when Sutter made his entrada there, was still totally tribal country. Only a couple of earlier explorers had been up the Sacramento River as far as Sutter went, and they turned around and left right away because there was nothing up. They just were looking around. And they left these little dinky maps, but it was a country of native tribes that had never been touched by European influence. And like all the descriptions of the Central Valley in those years, just teeming with wildlife, huge herds of elk and herds of grizzly, of antelope and flocks of geese and ducks, you know, by the many thousands flying overhead. And that sort of stuff, and Sutter just, you know, sails right up into it, looking for the place where he can stick his spear in the ground and establish this, what he hopes will be a private empire in the West.
And he didn't get his empire, but he went up in 1839, and I'd say within 20 years that had all been destroyed.
It was you know, quickly. Especially after the gold rush was really the end of tribal life in Northern California, when suddenly a guy like Sutter can do a certain amount of damage, but and then in the next 8 or 10 years, you start to have these wagon parties coming over the mountains, and they do a little bit more intruding into the indigenous way of life. But suddenly, you know, by 1850, 1851, you've got 150,000 gold-crazed Argonauts roaming around trying to make something happen. And that was the beginning of the end for tribal life out in California.
Were there many Hawaiian native mixes?
There were quite a few. You know, one of the things that fascinates me about that Hawaiian presence, you have these 10 Hawaiians who come into California with John Sutter, who himself had come to California from Hawaii, even though he was Swiss, which is an interesting story in itself, how he got to Hawaii first. But he comes in with these 10 Hawaiians, and they come up the Sacramento River with him, and the first buildings that are erected in Sacramento, in what is now the capital of the state of California, were Hawaiian grass houses. And then they set to work to help him build the fort as we have come to remember it. But when those first wagon parties began to come up through the Sierra and sort of establish the legend, the prevailing narrative of California settlement from John Bidwell onward, and these heroic and very courageous people heading from east to west, when they got to Sutter's Fort, the Hawaiians were already there. The Hawaiians had come into California from the other direction, traveling not from east to west, but from west to east. And, you know, earlier you were talking about the Chinese. By the 1849, 1850, California was very much a cultural crossroads, with Hawaiians and Chinese coming in from the Pacific side, and Mexican settlers having already come up from the south, and these Anglos and Europeans coming over the mountains from the east, and the indigenous peoples that were already here. It was an extraordinary mix for those times. A lot of people think California has sort of recently become a cultural crossroads, but that's what it's been for 160 years.
The way you draw the interactions between all the characters is quite convincing, and I'm curious which of the characters are actually fictitious. I assume that Nani Keala is, there was no such person.
Well, I came across a story. You know, all the Hawaiians who came in with Sutter married in after the gold rush, that dispersed the population of Sutter's Fort, and they all, everybody who worked there pretty much had to go somewhere else. And they all began to mix in with these Northern California tribes. And to this day, there are a lot of descendants of those mixtures sprinkled around, scattered around all the Sacramento area up north there. People who are descended from Hawaiian California marriages and mixtures, California Indian and Hawaiian mixtures. And I came across the story of a woman who was the daughter of a California Indian woman and one of Sutter's Hawaiians, who had a rather extraordinary life. And it was hard to tell from the story and the information that has come down into our time how much of it was true, how much of it was kind of elaborated on, how much of it had moved into the realm of legend, the way a lot of family stories do when they're told over and over and over again. But there was something there that captivated me, the idea of a woman with that kind of background who, by the time she's 18, 20 years old, can speak three languages. She can speak Hawaiian from her father. She can speak her mother's tribal tongue. She can also speak English because she spent some time working as a domestic at a white ranch. This creates a character with terrific kind of cultural mobility. She can speak three languages, and she has her hand in three different cultures. And that, from a novelist's point of view, that was just, well, from my point of view as a novelist, that was just too good to leave alone.
Are some of the other characters real? Was there, especially Giles Peabody,
Well, Giles Peabody, he's in the novel, he's the descendant of one of the original missionaries who came into Hawaii in the 1820s, and he's a kind of composite of a number of characters like that who were in Honolulu in the 1880s and 90s and really working very deliberately to sabotage the king's stature and ultimately topple the monarchy. That was their agenda for a long time.
And if the king had lived, do you think he might have been able to preserve the monarchy?
Well, you know, when the monarchy was overthrown, finally, after he died, his sister, Liliuokalani, ascended to the throne, and she was there for a couple of years, and she was the queen when the overthrow finally took place. But the first reaction to what happened in Honolulu came from Grover Cleveland, who was then President of the United States, who wrote a long letter to the guys who had orchestrated the overthrow, and he said, hey, you can't do this. This is the United States. We do not go into little tiny countries who have done nothing to us and take over their government. This is a democracy, not a tyranny. And he just, you know, he really put his foot down and he said, cut it out. Restore the monarchy, put the queen back on the throne. And that was an attitude that prevailed all over the United States. And the guys in Hawaii said, the hell with you. We took over the government. We're still in charge. If you want us to do it another way, send a military force out here and make us. And it was very difficult because Cleveland was against the overthrow, and a lot of people in the Senate were against the overthrow. But, you know, have to bear in mind, Hawaii was a long way away from everything else in 1893. It took a long time to get out there. It took a long time. There was no Panama Canal. It took weeks to send ships out there if you were going to send a military force. And also, the United States was then at the edge of bankruptcy, and Grover Cleveland, the president, had huge problems on his hand in D.C. So the guys in Hawaii really got away with highway robbery.
This is Booktown on KVMR, Nevada City. I'm Eric Tome. I've been talking for the last 25 minutes and could probably talk for another hour or so with James D. Houston, author most recently of Bird of Another Heaven, a novel that takes place, jumps back and forth between the 1880s and 90s and the 1980s between Hawaii and Northern California, and is a fascinating read. Thanks so much for being with us.
Well, thank you, Eric. I'm so glad you took an interest in this book. It's great to talk with you about it.
Okay. I've got to make way now for the next program. Jimmy Accardi's Rock and Roll Party will be here in just a few minutes. Before that, a couple of things you might like to know about. And KVMR is actually going to be broadcasting a series very closely related to the two books we've been talking about. It's Crossing East, the first public radio series on Asian American history. It is comprised of 8 one-hour documentaries on the many waves of Asian immigration into the U.S. and their impact on the making of America. That starts this Wednesday at 1 p.m. and will continue most Wednesdays after that. It may occasionally skip a week, but it'll come here through the summer. That's a co-production of KVMR and the Community Asian Theater of the Sierra. There's also one event coming up this Saturday. Local author, teacher and author, Kim Culbertson will be presenting her new novel, new young adult novel, Songs for a Teenage Nomad, at the Center for the Arts in Grass Valley at 2 p.m. That's 2 p.m. next Saturday. Now I really am going to get out of here, and Jimmy Accardi will be here as fast as he can.